for sport. And he a-cussin' and threatenin' with all his might, and so tired he couldn't walk, and couldn't do nothing to them. The Duke, he began to abuse him for an old fool, and the King begun to sass back, and the minute they was fairly at it, I lit out and shook the reefs out of my hind legs, and spun down the river road like a deer, for I see our chance. And I made up my mind that it would be a long day before they ever see me and Jim again. I got down there all out of breath, but loaded up with joy, and sung out, "Set her loose, Jim! We're all right now!" But there weren't no answer, and nobody come out of the wigwam. Jim was gone! I set up a shout, and then another one, and run this way and that in the woods, whooping and screeching, but it weren't no use. Old Jim was gone. Then I sat down and cried. I couldn't help it. But I couldn't set still long. Pretty soon I went out on the road trying to think what I better do, and I run across a boy walking and asked him if he'd seen a strange nigger dressed so and so, and he says, "Yes." "Whereabouts?" says I. "Down to Silas Phelps' place, 2 miles below here. He's a runaway nigger, and they've got him." "Was you looking for him?" "Well, you bet I ain't. I run across him in the woods about an hour or two ago, and he said if I hollered he'd cut my livers out, and told me to lay down and stay where I was, and I done it. Been there ever since, afeared to come out." "Well," he says, "you needn't be afeared no more, because they've got him. He run off from down south, Summers." "It's a good job they got him." "Well, I reckon. There's $200 reward on him. It's like picking up money out in the road." "Yes, it is. And I could have had it if I'd been big enough. I see him first." "Who nailed him?" "It was an old fellow, a stranger, and he sold out his chance in him for $40 because he's got to go up the river and can't wait." "Think of that now. You bet I'd wait if it was 7 year." "Well, that's me every time," says I. "But maybe his chance ain't worth no more than that if he'll sell it so cheap. Maybe there's something ain't straight about him." "But it is, though. Straight as a string. I see the handbill myself. It tells all about him to a dot, paints him like a picture, and tells the plantation he's from, below New Orleans. No siree, Bob. They ain't no trouble about that speculation, you bet you. Say, give me a chaw tobacco, won't you?" I didn't have none, so he left. I went to the raft and sat down on the wigwam to think, but I couldn't come to nothing. I thought till I wore my head sore, but I couldn't see no way out of the trouble. After all this long journey and after all we'd done for them scoundrels, here was it all come to nothing. Everything all busted up and ruined because they could have the heart to serve Jim such a trick as that and make him a slave again all his life and among strangers, too, for 40 dirty dollars. Once I said to myself it would be 1,000 times better for Jim to be a slave at home where his family was, as long as he'd got to be a slave. And so I'd better write a letter to Tom Sawyer and tell him to tell Miss Watson where he was. But I soon give up that notion for 2 things. She'd be mad and disgusted at his rascality and ungratefulness for leaving her, and so she'd sell him straight down the river again. And if she didn't, everybody naturally despises an ungrateful nigger, and they'd make Jim feel it all the time, and so he'd feel ornery and disgraced. And then think of me. It would get all around that Huck Finn helped a nigger to get his freedom, and if I was to ever see anybody from that town again, I'd be ready to get down and lick his boots for shame. That's just the way. A person does a low-down thing, and then he don't want to take no consequences of it. Thinks as long as he can hide it, it ain't no disgrace. That was my fix, exactly. The more I studied about this, the more my conscience went to grinding me, and the more wicked and low-down and ornery I got to feeling. And at last, when it hit me all of a sudden that here was the plain hand of Providence slapping me in the face and letting me know my wickedness was being watched all the time from up there in heaven, whilst I was stealing a poor old woman's nigger that had never done me no harm, and now was showing me there's one that's always on the lookout and ain't a-going to allow no such miserable doings to go only just so fur and no further, I most dropped to my tracks, I was so scared. Well, I tried the best I could to conder soften it up somehow for myself by saying I was brung up wicked, and so I weren't so much to blame. But something inside of me kept saying, there was the Sunday school. You could have gone to it. And if you'd have done it, they'd have learnt you there that people that acts as I'd been acting about that nigger goes to everlasting fire. It made me shiver, and I about made up my mind to pray and see if I couldn't try to quit being the kind of boy I was and be better. So I kneeled down, but the words wouldn't come. Why wouldn't they? It weren't no use to try and hide it from him, nor from me neither. I knowed very well why they wouldn't come. It was because my heart weren't right. It was because I weren't square. It was because I was playing double. I was letting on to give up sin, but away inside of me I was holding on to the biggest one of all. I was trying to make my mouth say I would do the right thing and the clean thing, and going right to that nigger's owner and tell where he was. But deep down in me I knowed it was a lie. And he knowed it. You can't pray a lie. I found that out. So I was full of trouble, full as I could be, and didn't know what to do. At last I had an idea, and I says I'll go and write the letter, and then see if I can pray. Why, it was astonishing the way I felt as light as a feather, right straight off, and my troubles all gone. So I got a piece of paper and a pencil, all glad and excited, and sat down and wrote, Miss Watson, your runaway nigger Jim is down here 2 mile below Pikesville, and Mr. Phelps has got him, and he will give him up for the reward if you send. Huck Finn. I felt good, and all washed clean of sin for the first time I had ever felt so in my life, and I knowed I could pray now. But I didn't do it straight off, but laid the paper down and sat there thinking. Thinking how good it was all this happened so, and how near I come to being lost and going to hell. And went on thinking, and got to thinking over our trip down the river. And I see Jim before me, all the time, in the day and in the night time, sometimes moonlight, sometimes storms, and we are floating along, talking and singing and laughing. But somehow I couldn't seem to strike no places to harden me against him, but only the other kind. I'd see him standing my watch on top of his'n, instead of calling me, so I could go on sleeping. And see him how glad he was when I come back out of the fog, and when I come to him again in the swamp, up there where the feud was, and such like times, and would always call me honey and pet me and do everything he could think of for me, and how good he always was. And at last, I struck the time I saved him by telling the men we had smallpox aboard. And he was so grateful, and said I was the best friend old Jim ever had in the world, and the only one he's got now. And then I happened to look around and see that paper. It was a close place. I took it up and held it in my hand. I was a-trembling because I'd got to decide, forever, betwixt two things, and I knowed it. I studied a minute, sort of holding my breath, and then says to myself, all right, then, I'll go to hell, and tore it up. It was awful thoughts and awful words, but they was said, and I let them stay said, and never thought no more about reforming. I shoved the whole thing out of my head and said I would take up wickedness again, which was in my line, being brung up to it, and the other weren't. And for a starter, I would go to work and steal Jim out of slavery again. And if I could think up anything worse, I would do that too. Because as long as I was in, and in for good, I might as well go the whole hog. Then I set to thinking over how to get at it, and turned over considerable many ways in my mind, and at last fixed up a plan that suited me. So then I took the bearings of a woody island that was down the river a piece, and as soon as it was fairly dark, I crept out with my raft and went for it, and hid it there, and then turned in. I slept the night through and got up before it was light, and had my breakfast, and put on my store clothes, and tied up some others and one thing or another in a bundle, and took the canoe and cleared for shore. I landed below, where I judge was Phelps' place, and hid my bundle in the woods, and then filled up the canoe with water, and loaded rocks into her and sunk her where I could find her again when I wanted her, about a quarter of a mile below a little stream sawmill that was on the bank. Then I struck up the road, and when I passed the mill, I see a sign on it. Phelps's Sawmill. And when I come to the farmhouses, 200 or 300 yards further along, I kept my eyes peeled, but didn't see nobody around, though it was good daylight now. But I didn't mind, because I didn't want to see nobody just yet. I only wanted to get the lay of the land. According to my plan, I was going to turn up there from the village, not from below. So I just took a look and shoved along straight for town. Well, the very first man I see when I got there was the Duke. He was sticking up a bill for the Royal Nonesuch, 3-night performance, like that other time. They had the cheek, them frauds. I was right on him before I could shirk. He looked astonished and says, "Hello, where'd you come from?" Then he says, kind of glad and eager, "Where's the raft? Got her in a good place?" I says, "Why, that's just what I was going to ask your grace." Then he didn't look so joyful, and says, "What was your idea for asking me?" he says. "Well," I says, "when I see the king in that doggery yesterday, I says to myself, we can't get him home for hours till he's sober. So I went a-loafing around town to put in the time and wait. A man up and offered me 10 cents to help him pull his skiff over the river and back to fetch a sheep. And so I went along. But when we was dragging him to the boat, and the man left me a hold of the rope and went behind him to shove him along, he was too strong for me, and jerked loose and run, and we after him. We didn't have no dog, and so we had to chase him all over the country till we tired him out. We never got him till dark, then we fetched him over, and I started down for the raft. When I got there and see it was gone, I says to myself, they've got into trouble and had to leave, and they've took my nigger, which is the only nigger I've got in the world, and now I'm in a strange country, and I ain't got no property no more, nor nothing, and no way to make my living. So I sat down and cried. I slept in the woods all night. But what did become of the raft then? And Jim, poor Jim. Blamed if I know. That is, what's become of the raft. That old fool had made a trade and got $40. And when we found him in the doggery, the loafers had matched half dollars with him and got every cent but what he'd spent for whiskey. And when I got him home late last night and found the raft gone, we said, that little rascal has stole our raft and shook us and run off down the river. I wouldn't shake my nigger, would I? The only nigger I had in the world and the only property. We never thought of that. Fact is, I reckon we'd come to consider him our nigger. Yes, we did consider him so. Goodness knows we had trouble enough for him. So when we see the raft was gone and we flat broke, there weren't anything for it but to try the Royal Nonesuch another shake. And I've pegged along ever since, dry as a powder horn. Where's that 10 cents? Give it here. I had considerable money, so I give him 10 cents, but begged him to spend it for something to eat, and give me some, because it was all the money I had, and I hadn't had nothing to eat since yesterday. He never said nothing. The next minute he whirls on me and says, "Do you reckon that nigger would blow on us? We'd skin him if he'd done that." "How can he blow? Hain't he run off?" "No. That old fool sold him, and never divided with me, and the money's gone." "Sold him?" I says, and begun to cry. "Why, he was my nigger, and that was my money. Where is he? I want my nigger." "Well, you can't get your nigger, that's all. So dry up your blubbering. Looky here, do you think you'd venture to blow on us?" "Blamed if I think I'd trust you." "Why, if you was to blow on us..." He stopped, but I never see the Duke look so ugly out of his eyes before. I went on a-whimpering and says, "I don't want to blow on nobody. I ain't got no time to blow nohow. I gotta turn out and find my nigger." He looked kind of bothered and stood there with his bills fluttering on his arm, thinking and wrinkling up his forehead. At last he says, "I'll tell you something. We got to be here 3 days. If you'll promise you won't blow and won't let the nigger blow, I'll tell you where to find him. So I promised, and he says, a farmer by the name of Silas F... And then he stopped. You see, he started to tell me the truth, but when he stopped that way and begun to study and think again, I reckoned he was changing his mind, and so he was. He wouldn't trust me. He wanted to make sure of having me out of the way the whole 3 days. So pretty soon he says, the man that bought him is named Abram Foster, Abram G. Foster, and he lives 40 miles back here in the country on the road to Lafayette. All right, I says, I can walk it in 3 days, and I'll start this very afternoon. No, you won't. You'll start now. And don't you lose any time about it, neither, nor do any gabbling, by the way. Just keep a tight tongue in your head and move right along, and then you won't get into trouble with us. Do you hear? That was the order I wanted, and that was the one I played for. I wanted to be left free to work my plans. So clear out, he says, and you can tell Mr. Foster whatever you want to. Maybe you can get him to believe that Jim is your nigger. Some idiots don't require documents. Leastways, I've heard there's such down south here. And when you tell him the handbill and the reward's bogus, maybe he'll believe you when you explain to him what the idea was for getting him out. Go along now and tell him anything you want to. But mind you, don't work your jaw any between here and there. So I left and struck for the back country. I didn't look around, but I kind of felt like he was watching me. But I knowed I could tire him out at that. I went straight out in the country as much as a mile before I stopped. Then I doubled back through the woods towards Phelps's. I reckoned I better start into my plan straight off, without fooling around, because I wanted to stop Jim's mouth till these fellers could get away. I didn't want no trouble with their kind. I'd seen all I wanted to of them, and wanted to get entirely shut of them. Chapter 32. When I got there, it was all still and Sunday-like, and hot and sunshiny. The hands was gone to the fields, and there was them kind of faint dronings of bugs and flies in the air that makes it seem so lonesome and like everybody's dead and gone. And if a breeze fans along and quivers the leaves, it makes you feel mournful, because you feel like it's spirits whispering, spirits that's been dead ever so many years, and you always think they're talking about you. As a general thing, it makes a body wish he was dead too, and done with it all. Phelps's was one of these little one-horse cotton plantations, and they all look alike. A rail fence round a 2-acre yard, a stile made out of logs sawed off and upended in steps, like barrels of a different length, to climb over the fence with, and for the women to stand on when they are going to jump onto a horse. Some sickly grass patches in the big yard, but mostly it was bare and smooth like an old hat with the nap rubbed off. Big double log house for the white folks, hewed logs with the chinks stopped up with mud or mortar, and these mud straps been whitewashed sometime or another. Round log kitchen, with a big broad open but roof passage joining it to the house. Log smokehouse back of the kitchen. 3 little log nigger cabins in a row t'other side of the smokehouse. 1 little hut all by itself away down against the back fence, and some outbuildings down a piece to the other side. Ash hopper and big kettle to bile soap in by the little hut. Bench by the kitchen door with bucket of water and a gourd. Hound asleep there in the sun, more hounds asleep round about. About 3 shade trees way off in a corner, some currant bushes and gooseberry bushes in one place by the fence. Outside of the fence, a garden and a watermelon patch. Then the cotton fields begins, and after the fields, the woods. I went around and clumb over the back stile by the ash hopper and started for the kitchen. When I got a little ways, I heard the dim hum of a spinning wheel wailing along up and sinking along down again. And then I knowed for certain I wish I was dead, for that is the lonesomest sound in the whole world. I went right along, not fixing up any particular plan, but just trusting to Providence to put the right words in my mouth when the time come. For I'd noticed that Providence always did put the right words in my mouth if I left it alone. When I got halfway, first one hound and then another got up and went for me, and of course I stopped and faced them and kept still. And such another powwow as they made. In a quarter of a minute, I was a kind of a hub of a wheel, as you may say. Spokes made out of dogs. Circle of 15 of them packed together around me, with their necks and noses stretched up towards me, a-barking and howling. And more a-coming. You could see them sailing over fences and around corners from everywheres. A nigger woman come tearing out of the kitchen with a rolling pin in her hand, singing out, "Begone, you tag! You spot! Begone, sir!" And she fetched first one and then another of them a clip and sent them howling. And then the rest followed. And the next second, half of them come back, wagging their tails around me and making friends with me. There ain't no harm in a hound, nohow. And behind the woman comes a little nigger girl and two little nigger boys, without anything on but tow linen shirts. And they hung on to their mother's gown and peeped out from behind her at me, bashful, the way they always do. And here comes the white woman running from the house, about 45 or 50 year old, bareheaded, and her spinning stick in her hand. And behind her comes her little white children, acting the same way the little niggers was doing. She was smiling all over so she could hardly stand, and says,
"It's you, at last, ain't it?"
I out with a yes'm, before I thought. She grabbed me and hugged me tight, and then gripped me by both hands, and shook, and the tears come in her eyes and run down over, and she couldn't seem to hug and shake enough, and kept saying,
"You don't look as much like your mother as I reckoned you would, but law's sakes, I don't care for that. I'm so glad to see you. Dear, dear, it does seem like I could eat you up. Children, it's your cousin Tom. Tell him howdy."
But they ducked their heads and put their fingers in their mouths and hid behind her. So she run on.
"Lize, hurry up and get him a hot breakfast right away. Or did you get your breakfast on the boat?"
I said I had got it on the boat. So then she started for the house, leading me by the hand and the children tagging after. When we got there, she set me down in a split-bottom chair and set herself down on a little low stool in front of me, holding both of my hands, and says,
"Now I can have a good look at you, and laws of me, I've been hungry for it a many and a many a time, all these long years, and it's come at last. We've been expecting you a couple of days and more. What's kept you? Boat get aground?"
Yes'm, she...
"Don't say yes'm, say Aunt Sally. Where'd you get aground?"
I didn't rightly know what to say, because I didn't know whether the boat would be coming up the river or down. But I go a good deal on instinct, and my instinct said she would be coming up, from down towards Orleans. That didn't help me much, though, for I didn't know the names of bars down that way. I see I'd got to invent a bar, or forget the name of the one we got aground on, or... Now I struck an idea, and fetched it out. Well, it weren't the grounding. That didn't keep us back but a little. We blowed out a cylinder head.
Good gracious! Anybody hurt?
No, 'em. Killed a nigger.
Well, it's lucky, because sometimes people do get hurt. 2 years ago last Christmas, your Uncle Silas was coming up from New Orleans on the old Lally Rook, and she blowed out a cylinder head and crippled a man. And I think he died afterwards. He was a Baptist. Your Uncle Silas knowed a family in Baton Rouge that knowed his people very well. Yes, I remember. Now he did die. Mortification set in, and they had to amputate him. But it didn't save him. Yes, it was mortification, that it was. He turned blue all over and died in the hope of a glorious resurrection. They say he was a sight to look at. Your uncle's been up to the town every day to fetch you, and he's gone again not more than an hour ago. He'll be back any minute now. You must have met him on the road, didn't you? Oldish man with a...
No, I didn't see nobody, Aunt Sally. The boat landed just at daylight, and I left my baggage on the wharf boat and went looking around the town and out a piece in the country, to put in the time and not get here too soon, and so I come down the back way.
Who'd you give the baggage to?
Nobody.
Why, child, it'll be stole.
Not where I hid it, I reckon it won't, I says.
How'd you get your breakfast so early on the boat?
It was kinder thin ice, but I says, the captain see me standing around and told me I better have something to eat before I went ashore, so he took me in the Texas to the officer's lunch and give me all I wanted. I was getting so uneasy I couldn't listen good. I had my mind on the children all the time. I wanted to get them out to one side and pump them a little and find out who I was, but I couldn't get no show. Mrs. Phelps kept it up and run on so. Pretty soon she made the cold chill streak all down my back, because she says,
"But here we're a-running on this way, and you hain't told me a word about Sis, nor any of them. Now I'll rest my works a little, and you start up yourn. Just tell me everything. Tell me all about 'em and all. Every one of 'em, and how they are, and what they're doing, and what they told you to tell me, and every last thing you can think of."
Well, I see I was up a stump, and up it good. Providence had stood by me this fur, all right, but I was hard and tight aground now. I see it weren't a bit of use to try to go ahead. I'd got to throw up my hand. So I says to myself, "Here's another place where I got to risk the truth." I opened my mouth to begin, but she grabbed me and hustled me in behind the bed and says,
"Here he comes. Stick your head down lower. There, that'll do. You can't be seen now. Don't you let on you're here. I'll play a joke on him. Children, don't you say a word."
I see I was in a fix now, but it weren't no use to worry. There weren't nothing to do but just hold still and try and be ready to stand from under when the lightning struck. I had just one little glimpse of the old gentleman when he come in. Then the bed hit him. Mrs. Phelps, she jumps for him and says,
"Has he come?"
"No," says her husband.
"Goodness gracious," she says. "What in the world can have become of him?"
"I can't imagine," says the old gentleman. "And I must say, it makes me dreadful uneasy."
"Uneasy," she says. "I'm ready to go distracted. He must have come, and you've missed him along the road. I know it's so. Something tells me so."
"Why, Sally, I couldn't have missed him along the road. You know that."
"But, oh, dear, dear, what will Sis say? He must have come. You must have missed him.
Oh, don't distress me any more, and I'm already distressed. I don't know what in the world to make of it. I'm at my wit's end, and I don't mind acknowledging Tom right down scared. But there's no hope that he's come, for he couldn't come and me miss him. Sally, it's terrible, just terrible. Something's happened to the boat, sure."
"Why, Silas, look yonder, up the road. Ain't that somebody coming?"
He sprung to the window at the head of the bed, and that gave Mrs. Phelps the chance she wanted. She stooped down quick at the foot of the bed and gave me a pull, and out I come. And when he turned back from the window, there she stood, a-beamin' and a-smilin' like a house afire, and I standin' pretty meek and sweaty alongside. The old gentleman stared and says, "Why, who's that?"
"Who do you reckon 'tis?"
"I ain't no idea. Who is it?"
"It's Tom Sawyer."
By jings, I most slumped through the floor. But there weren't no time to swap knives. The old man grabbed me by the hand and shook and kept on shaking. And all the time how the woman did dance around and laugh and cry. And then how they both did fire off questions about Sid and Mary and the rest of the tribe. But if they was joyful, it weren't nothing to what I was. For it was like being born again, I was so glad to find out who I was. Well, they froze to me for 2 hours, and at last, when my chin was so tired it couldn't hardly go any more, I had told them more about my family, I mean the Sawyer family, than ever happened to any 6 Sawyer families. And I explained all about how we blowed out a cylinder head at the mouth of White River, and it took us 3 days to fix it. Which was all right and worked first rate, because they didn't know but what it would take 3 days to fix it. If I'd have called it a bolt head, it would have done just as well. Now I was feeling pretty comfortable all down one side, and pretty uncomfortable all up the other. Being Tom Sawyer was easy and comfortable, and it stayed easy and comfortable, till by and by I hear a steamboat coughing along down the river. Then I says to myself, "Suppose Tom Sawyer come down on that boat, and suppose he steps in here any minute and sings out my name before I can throw him a wink to keep quiet." Well, I couldn't have it that way. It wouldn't do at all. I must go up the road and waylay him. So I told the folks I reckoned I would go up to the town and fetch down my baggage. The old gentleman was for going along with me, but I said no. I could drive the horse myself, and I'd druther he wouldn't take no trouble about me. Chapter 33. So I started for town in the wagon, and when I was halfway, I see a wagon coming, and sure enough, it was Tom Sawyer. And I stopped and waited till he come along. I says, "Hold on!" And it stopped alongside, and his mouth opened like a trunk and stayed so. And he swallowed two or three times like a person that's got a dry throat, and then says, "I ain't ever done you no harm. You know that. So then, what you want to come back and haunt me for?" I says, "I hain't come back. I hain't been gone." When he heard my voice, it righted him up some, but he weren't quite satisfied yet. He says, "Don't you play nothing on me, because I wouldn't on you. Honest Injun now, you ain't a ghost?" "Honest Injun, I ain't," I says. "Well, well, that ought to settle it, of course. But I can't somehow seem to understand it no way. Looky here, weren't you ever murdered at all?" "No, I weren't ever murdered at all. I played it on them." "You come in here and feel me if you don't believe me." So he done it, and it satisfied him. And he was that glad to see me again, he didn't know what to do. And he wanted to know all about it right off, because it was a grand adventure, and mysterious, and so it hit him where he lived. But I said, "Leave it alone till by and by," and told his driver to wait, and we drove off a little piece, and I told him what kind of fix I was in, and what did he reckon we better do. He said, "Let him alone a minute, and don't disturb him." So he thought and thought, and pretty soon he says, "It's all right, I've got it. Take my trunk in your wagon, and let on it's yourn. And you turn back and fool along slow so as to get to the house about the time you ought to. And I'll go towards town a piece and take a fresh start and get there a quarter or a half an hour after you, and you needn't let on to know me at first." I says, "All right, but wait a minute. There's one more thing, a thing that nobody don't know but me. And that is, there's a nigger here that I'm a-trying to steal out of slavery, and his name is Jim, old Miss Watson's Jim." He says, "What? Why, Jim is..." He stopped and went to studying. I says, "I know what you'll say. You'll say it's dirty low-down business. But what if it is? I'm low-down, and I'm a-going to steal him, and I want you to keep mum and not let on. Will you?" His eye lit up, and he says, "I'll help you steal him." Well, I let go all holts then like I was shot. It was the most astonishing speech I ever heard, and I'm bound to say Tom Sawyer fell considerable in my estimation. Only I couldn't believe it. Tom Sawyer, a nigger stealer. "Oh, shucks," I says, "you're joking." "I ain't joking either." "Well, then," I says, "joking or no joking, if you hear anything said about a runaway nigger, don't forget to remember that you don't know nothing about him, and I don't know nothing about him." Then we took the trunk and put it in my wagon, and he drove off his way, and I drove mine. But of course I forgot all about driving slow on account of being glad and full of thinking. So I got home a heap too quick for that length of a trip. The old gentleman was at the door, and he says, "Why, this is wonderful. Whoever would have thought it was in that mare to do it? I wish we'd have timed her, and she ain't sweated a hair, not a hair. It's wonderful. Why, I wouldn't take $100 for that horse now. I wouldn't, honest. And yet I'd sold her for 15 before and thought 'twas all she was worth." That's all he said. He was the innocentest, best old soul I ever see. But it weren't surprising, because he weren't only just a farmer. He was a preacher, too, and had a little one-horse log church down back of the plantation, which he built it himself at his own expense, for a church and schoolhouse, and never charged nothing for his preaching, and it was worth it, too. There was plenty other farmer preachers like that, and done the same way down south. In about half an hour, Tom's wagon drove up to the front stile, and Aunt Sally, she'd see it through the window because it was only about 50 yards, and says, "Why, there's somebody come. I wonder who 'tis. Why, I do believe it's a stranger. Jimmy," that's one of the children, "run and tell Lize to put on another plate for dinner." Everybody made a rush for the front door, because, of course, a stranger don't come every year, and so he lays over the yaller fever for interest when he does come. Tom was over the stile, and starting for the house. The wagon was spinning up the road for the village, and we was all bunched in the front door. Tom had his store clothes on and an audience, and that was always nuts for Tom Sawyer. In them circumstances, it weren't no trouble to him to throw in an amount of style that was suitable. He weren't a boy to meek you along up that yard like a sheep. Nope, he come calm and important like the ram. When he got a front of us, he lifts his hat ever so gracious and dainty, like it was the lid of a box that had butterflies asleep in it, and he didn't want to disturb them, and says, "Mr. Archibald Nichols, I presume?" "No, my boy," says the old gentleman. "I'm sorry to say your driver has deceived you. Nichols's place is down a matter of 3 mile more. Come in, come in." Tom, he took a look back over his shoulder and says, "Too late. He's out of sight." "Yes, he's gone, my son, and you must come in and eat your dinner with us, and then we'll hitch up and take you down to Nichols's." "Oh, I can't make you so much trouble. I couldn't think of it. I'll walk. I don't mind the distance." "But we won't let you walk. It wouldn't be Southern hospitality to do it. Come right in."
"Oh, do," says Aunt Sally. "It ain't a bit of trouble to us, not a bit in the world. You must stay. It's a long, dusty 3 mile, and we can't let you walk. And besides, I've already told him to put on another plate when I see you coming. So you mustn't disappoint us. Come right in and make yourself at home."
So Tom, he thanked them very hearty and handsome, and let himself be persuaded and come in. And when he was in, he said he was a stranger from Hicksville, Ohio, and his name was William Thompson, and he made another bow. Well, he run on and on and on, making up stuff about Hicksville and everybody in it he could invent. And I getting a little nervous and wondering how this was going to help me out of my scrape. And at last, still talking along, he reached over and kissed Aunt Sally right in the mouth and then settled back again in his chair, comfortable, and was going on talking. But she jumped up and wiped it off with the back of her hand and says,
"You audacious puppy!"
He looked kind of hurt and says,
"I'm surprised at you, ma'am."
"You're surpri-
Why, what do you reckon I am? I've a good notion to take and say, what do you mean by kissing me?"
He looked kind of humble and says,
"I didn't mean nothing, ma'am. I didn't mean no harm. I thought you'd like it."
"Why, you born fool!"
She took up the spinning stick, and it looked like it was all she could do to keep from giving him a crack with it.
"What made you think I'd like it?"
"Well, I don't know. Only they told me you would."
"They told you I would? Whoever told you's another lunatic. I never heard the beat of it. Who's they?"
"Why, everybody. They all said so, ma'am."
It was all she could do to hold in, and her eyes snapped, and her fingers worked like she wanted to scratch him, and she says,
"Who's everybody? Out with their names, or there'll be an idiot short."
He got up and looked distressed, and fumbled his hat and says,
"I'm sorry, I weren't expecting it. They told me to. They all told me to. They all said kiss her, and said she'll like it. They all said it, every one of them. But I'm sorry, ma'am, and I won't do it no more. I won't, honest."
"You won't you? Well, I should reckon you won't."
"No'm, I'm honest about it. I won't ever do it again, till you ask me."
"Till I ask you? Well, I never see the beat of it in my born days. I lay you'll be the Methusalem numbskull of creation before ever I ask you, or the likes of you."
"Well," he says, "it does surprise me so. I can't make it out somehow. They said you would, and I thought you would, but..."
He stopped and looked around slow, like he wished he could run across a friendly eye somewheres, and fetched up on the old gentleman's and says,
"Didn't you think she'd like me to kiss her, sir?"
"Why, no, well, no, I believe I didn't."
Then he looks on around the same way to me and says,
"Tom, didn't you think Aunt Sally'd open out her arms and say, 'Sid Sawyer?'"
"My land,"
she says, breaking in and jumping for him.
"You impudent young rascal, to fool a body so!"
And was going to hug him, but he fended her off and says,
"No, not till you've asked me first."
So she didn't lose no time, but asked him, and hugged him and kissed him over and over again, and then turned him over to the old man, and he took what was left. And after they got a little quiet again, she says,
"Why, dear me, I never see such a surprise. We weren't looking for you at all, but only Tom. Sis never wrote to me about anybody coming but him.
It's because it weren't intended for any of us to come but Tom," he says. "But I begged and begged, and at the last minute she let me come, too. So coming down the river, me and Tom thought it would be a first-rate surprise for him to come here to the house first, and for me to by and by tag along and drop in and let on to be a stranger. But it was a mistake, Aunt Sally. This ain't no healthy place for a stranger to come."
"No, not impudent whelps, Sid. You ought to have your jaws boxed. I hain't been so put out since I don't know when. But I don't care. I don't mind the terms. I'd be willing to stand 1,000 such jokes to have you here. Well, to think of that performance. I don't deny it. I was most putrefied with astonishment when you give me that smack."
We had dinner out in that broad open passage betwixt the house and the kitchen, and there was things enough on that table for 7 families. And all hot, too. None of your flabby, tough meat that's laid in a cupboard in a damp cellar all night and tastes like a hunk of old, cold cannibal in the morning. Uncle Silas, he asked a pretty long blessing over it, but it was worth it. And it didn't cool it a bit, neither, the way I've seen them kind of interruptions do lots of times. There was a considerable good deal of talk all the afternoon, and me and Tom was on the lookout all the time. But it weren't no use. They didn't happen to say nothing about my runaway nigger, and we was afraid to try to work up to it. But at supper at night, one of the little boys says,
"Pa, mayn't Tom and Sid and me go to the show?"
"No," says the old man. "I reckon there ain't going to be any. And you couldn't go if there was, because the runaway nigger told Burton and me all about that scandalous show, and Burton said he would tell the people. So I reckon they've drove the audacious loafers out of town before this time." So there it was. But I couldn't help it. Tom and me was to sleep in the same room and bed. So, being tired, we bid good night and went up to bed, right after supper, and clumb out of the window and down the lightning rod and shoved for the town. For I didn't believe anybody was going to give the king and the duke a hint, and so if I didn't hurry up and give them one, they'd get into trouble, sure. On the road, Tom, he told me all about how it was reckoned I was murdered, and how Pap disappeared pretty soon and didn't come back no more, and what a stir there was when Jim run away. And I told Tom all about our royal nonsuch rapscallions, and as much of the raft voyage as I had time to. And as we struck into the town and up through the middle of it, it was as much as 8:30 then. Here comes a raging rush of people, with torches, and awful whooping and yelling, and banging tin pans and blowing horns, and we jumped to one side to let them go by. And as they went by, I see they had the king and the duke astraddle of a rail. That is, I knowed it was the king and the duke, though they was all over tar and feathers, and didn't look like nothing in the world that was human. Just looked like a couple of monstrous big soldier plumes. Well, it made me sick to see it, and I was sorry for them poor pitiful rascals. It seemed like I could never feel any hardness against them any more in the world. It was a dreadful thing to see. Human beings can be awful cruel to one another. We see we was too late, couldn't do no good. We asked some stragglers about it, and they said everybody went to the show looking very innocent, and laid low and kept dark, till the poor old king was in the middle of his cavortings on the stage. Then somebody gave a signal, and the house rose up and went for them. So we poked along back home, and I weren't feeling so brash as I was before, but kind of ornery and humble, and to blame somehow, though I hadn't done nothing. But that's always the way. It don't make no difference whether you do right or wrong. A person's conscience ain't got no sense, and just goes for 'em anyway. If I had a yaller dog that didn't know more than a person's conscience does, I would posit him. It takes up more room than all the rest of a person's insides, and yet ain't no good nohow. Tom Sawyer, he says the same. Chapter 34. We stopped talking and got to thinking. By and by, Tom says,
"Looky here, Huck, what fools we are to not think of it before. I bet I know where Jim is."
No. Where?
In that hut down with the ash hopper.
Why, looky here. When we was at dinner, didn't you see a nigger man go in there with some vittles?
Yes.
What did you think the vittles was for?
For a dog.
So'd I. Well, it wasn't for a dog.
Why?
Because part of it was watermelon.
So it was. I noticed it.
Well, it does beat all that I never thought about a dog not eating watermelon.
It shows how a body can see and don't see at the same time.
Well, the nigger unlocked the padlock when he went in, and he locked it again when he come out. He fetched Uncle a key about the time we got up from table. Same key, I bet. Watermelon shows man. Lock shows prisoner. And it ain't likely there's two prisoners on such a little plantation, and where the people's all so kind and good. Jim's the prisoner.
All right. I'm glad we found it out detective fashion. I wouldn't give shucks for any other way.
Now, you work your mind and study out a plan to steal Jim, and I will study out one too, and we'll take the one we like the best.
What a head for just a boy to have.
If I had Tom Sawyer's head, I wouldn't trade it off to be a duke, nor maid of a steamboat, nor clown in a circus, nor nothing I can think of. I went to thinking out a plan, but only just to be doing something. I knowed very well where the right plan was going to come from. Pretty soon, Tom says,
"Ready?"
"Yes," I says.
"All right, bring it out."
"My plan is this," I says. "We can easy find out if it's Jim in there. Then get up my canoe tomorrow night and fetch my raft over from the island. Then the first dark night that comes, steal the key out of the old man's breeches after he goes to bed and shove off down the river on the raft with Jim, hiding daytimes and running nights the way me and Jim used to do before. Wouldn't that plan work?"
"Work?
Why, certainly it would work, like rats a-fighting. But it's too blame simple. There ain't nothing to it. What's the good of a plan that ain't no more trouble than that? It's as mild as goose milk. Why, Huck, it wouldn't make no more talk than breaking into a soap factory."
I never said nothing, because I weren't expecting nothing different. But I knowed mighty well that whenever he got his plan ready, it wouldn't have none of them objections to it. And it didn't. He told me what it was, and I see in a minute it was worth 15 of mine for style. It would make Jim just as free a man as mine would, and maybe get us all killed besides. So I was satisfied, and said we would waltz in on it. I needn't tell what it was here, because I knowed it wouldn't stay the way it was. I knowed he would be changing it around every which way as we went along, and heaving in new bulliness whenever he got a chance. And that is what he done. Well, one thing was dead sure, and that was that Tom Sawyer was in earnest and was actually going to help steal that nigger out of slavery. That was the thing that was too many for me. Here was a boy that was respectable and well brung up and had a character to lose, and folks at home that had characters. And he was bright and not leather-headed, and knowing and not ignorant, and not mean but kind. And yet, here he was, without any more pride or rightness or feeling than to stoop to this business and make himself a shame, and his family a shame, before everybody. I couldn't understand it, no way at all. It was outrageous, and I knowed I ought to just up and tell him so. And so to be his true friend, and let him quit the thing right where he was and save himself. And I did start to tell him, but he shut me up and says, "Don't you reckon I know what I'm about? Don't I generally know what I'm about?"
"Yes."
"Didn't I say I was going to help steal the nigger?"
"Yes."
"Well, then."
That's all he said, and that's all I said. It weren't no use to say any more, because when he said he'd do a thing, he always done it. But I couldn't make out how he was willing to go into this thing, so I just let it go, and never bothered no more about it. If he was bound to have it so, I couldn't help it. When we got home, the house was all dark and still, so we went on down to the hut by the ash hopper for to examine it. We went through the yard so as to see what the hands would do. They knowed us, and didn't make no more noise than country dogs is always doing when anything comes by in the night. When we got to the cabin, we took a look at the front and the two sides, and on the side I weren't acquainted with, which was the north side, we found a square window hole, up tolerable high, with just one stout board nailed across it. I says, "Here's the ticket.
This hole's big enough for Jim to get through if we wrench off the board. Tom says, it's as simple as tit-tat-toe, three in a row, and as easy as playing hooky. I should hope we can find a way that's a little more complicated than that, Huck Finn. Well, then, I says, how'll it do to saw him out, the way I'd done before I was murdered that time? That's more like, he says. It's real mysterious and troublesome and good, he says, but I bet we can find a way that's twice as long. There ain't no hurry. Let's keep looking around. Betwixt the hut and the fence on the backside was a lean-to that joined the hut at the eaves and was made out of plank. It was as long as the hut, but narrow, only about 6 foot wide. The door to it was at the south end and was padlocked. Tom, he went to the soap kettle and searched around and fetched back the iron thing they lift the lid with. So he took it and prized out one of the staples. The chain fell down, and we opened the door and went in, and shut it, and struck a match, and see the shed was only built against the cabin and hadn't no connection with it. And there weren't no floor to the shed, nor nothing in it but some old rusty played-out hose, and spades and picks and a crippled plow. The match went out, and so did we, and shoved in the staple again, and the door was locked as good as ever. Tom was joyful. He says, now we're all right. We'll dig him out. It'll take about a week. Then we started for the house, and I went in the back door. You only have to pull a buckskin latch string. They don't fasten the doors. But that weren't romantical enough for Tom Sawyer. No way would do him, but he must climb up the lightning rod. But after he got up halfway about three times and missed fire and fell every time, and the last time most busted his brains out, he thought he'd got to give it up. But after he was rested, he allowed he would give her one more turn for luck, and this time he made the trip. In the morning, we was up at break of day and down to the nigger cabins to pet the dogs and make friends with the nigger that fed Jim, if it was Jim that was being fed. The niggers was just getting through breakfast and starting for the fields, and Jim's nigger was piling up a tin pan with bread and meat and things. And whilst the others was leaving, the key come from the house. This nigger had a good-natured, chuckle-headed face, and his wool was all tied up in little bunches with thread. That was to keep witches off. He said the witches was pestering him awful these nights and making him see all kinds of strange things and hear all kinds of strange words and noises. And he didn't believe he was ever witched so long before in his life. He got so worked up and got to running on so about his troubles, he forgot all about what he'd been a-going to do. So Tom says, what's the vittles for? Going to feed the dogs? The nigger kind of smiled around gradually over his face, like when you heave a brickbat in a mud puddle, and he says, yes, Mars Sid. A dog. Curious dog, too. Does you want to go and look at him? Yes. I hunched Tom and whispers, you going right here in the daybreak? That weren't the plan. No, it weren't, but it's the plan now. So drat him, we went along, but I didn't like it much. When we got in, we couldn't hardly see anything, it was so dark. But Jim was there, sure enough, and could see us, and he sings out, why, Huck, and good land, ain't that Mr. Tom? I just knowed how it would be. I just expected it. I didn't know nothing to do, and if I had, I couldn't have done it, because that nigger busted in and says, why, the gracious sakes, do he know you, gentlemen? We could see pretty well now. Tommy looked at the nigger, steady and kind of wondering, and says, does who know us? Why, this year runaway nigger. I don't reckon he does. But what put that into your head? What put it, though? Didn't he just a minute sing out like he knowed you? Tom says in a puzzled up kind of way, well, that's mighty curious. Who sung out? When did he sing out? What did he sing out? And turns to me, perfectly calm, and says, did you hear anybody sing out? Of course, there weren't nothing to be said but the one thing, so I says, no, I ain't heard nobody say nothing. Then he turns to Jim and looks him over like he never see him before and says, did you sing out?
No, sir, says Jim. I ain't said nothing, sir.
Not a word?
No, sir, I ain't said a word.
Did you ever see us before?
No, sir. Not as I knows on.
So Tom turns to the nigger, which was looking wild and distressed, and says kind of severe, "What do you reckon's the matter with you anyway? What made you think somebody sung out?"
"Oh, it's the dad-blamed witches, sir, and I wished I was dead, I do. They's allers at it, sir, and they do most kill me. They scares me so. Please to don't tell nobody about it, sir, or old Marse Silas, he scold me. 'Cause he said they ain't no witches. I just wish to goodness he was here now. Damn, what would he say? I just bet he couldn't find no way to get round it this time. But it's allers just so. People that's salt stays salt. They won't look into nothing and find it out for theyselves. And when you